This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Santa finishes checking his list, we have a couple of lists to go over. 10 best lists. A little later, our TV critic David Bianculli will be here to talk about the year in television. First, we're going to talk with our film critic David Edelstein about his picks for the best of the year. David, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love doing these 10 bests with you.
So, oh, me too, especially this year.
Was it a good year?
Oh, it's a miraculous year. I mean,
miraculous?
Given Hollywood's cataclysmic turn away from middle-range so-called grown-up movies, the Peter Pan in me hates me lauding anything grown-up, but still, when you just see a steady diet of blockbusters, comic book Marvel hero movies they can clean up with overseas, particularly in Asia, it's really great when so many interesting movies somehow or other manage to bleed through.
Well, okay, prove it to me. Tell me what's on your 10 best list.
Okay. Well, you know that it's a 10 best list of fictional movies, and then I have five documentary, non-fictional movies. Why, you ask, do I do this? Because I can. So here are the fictional 10 best films.
I let you get away with this every year.
Thank you so much. The first is Her, Spike Jonze, story of a man who falls in love with his operating system, and it is a soaringly romantic film. American Hustle is number two. That's David O. Russell's delightful abscam comedy. The third is Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing. Joss Whedon's essentially his home movie. He shot on a break from the Avengers in his backyard. Best Shakespeare comedy on film. Comedy, not tragedy. Short Term 12. Terrible title. The portrait of a Southern California short-term care facility for at-risk teenagers. Number five, All Is Lost, J.C. Chandler's one-man disaster picture with Robert Redford. Number six is a very small movie, Caesar Must Die. More Shakespeare, the great Taviani brothers, the great Italian directors. It's about Julius Caesar done by prisoners, many lifers. Number seven, Blue is the Warmest Color, the wonderful sexual coming-of-age film. Number eight, The Wind Rises. This is Hayao Miyazaki's supposedly last film, animated, but not for kids. Number nine, The World's End, the rollicking Edgar Wright genre-bending black comedy with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Number 10, Fruitvale Station, which is Ryan Coogler's debut film about the shooting of a young man in north of San Francisco, with a deep and searching performance by an actor named Michael B. Jordan.
Well, of those films, which surprised you the most that maybe you didn't expect to like and it ended up on your 10 best?
Well, I think Much Ado About Nothing was extremely surprising. Here you've got a director of superhero films and also Buffy the Vampire Slayer, let's give him credit, and a bunch of TV actors who have, what, 8 or 9 days on their hands, and they decide that he's going to shoot it in black and white, essentially in his backyard, one of Shakespeare's, you know, great comedies. And it turns out to be so much fun because it's fast and it's casual, and these people really know how to speak the verse. You know, they don't linger in this methody way on certain words so it ends up being incomprehensible. So I was very, very surprised. All Is Lost, J.C. Chandler's film. Who wants to spend 2 hours just staring at Robert Redford? He's been such a dull actor over the last 20 years. And yet this movie kind of pushes him to the limit of his own self-containment. And I thought it was enthralling.
So you have a separate list of the best documentaries of the year. And it seems like it's been for the past few years that documentaries have really become popular, that there's a place for them in theaters. People show up to see them. People talk about them. So do you think that that's like a growing trend?
Well, some people show up for them. There are still very few documentaries that cross over, and none of these documentary directors is getting rich. At the same time, because the means of production are so much less expensive, there are more people making them. And these films, you know, hold up against the best fictional films. The five I want to choose are The Act of Killing, which is Josh Oppenheimer's documentary in which he has Indonesian mass murderers reenact their atrocities from 40 years ago. The second is 20
These are
feet.
War atrocities, not
these
just
are war
serial
atrocities.
Murder atrocities.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, a million Indonesians were killed. in the late 60s. And these guys are still around. They're beloved by the government. And who would have thought that they love reenacting their crimes? They want to be movie stars. They think it's just great to play gangster on camera. The next film is 20 Feet from Stardom, Morgan Neville's film about backup singers, which actually has broken through. I guess it's made 4 or 5 million. And these singers have had, their careers have had a new life, people like Darlene Love and Mary Clayton and Lisa Fisher. Let the Fire Burn, Jason Osder's amazing documentary about the explosion, the conflagration of the MOVE headquarters in the 1980s. And let me just say why this is such an important film. It is all archival footage. There are no modern talking heads. And yet, stitching together all this footage from the time, he's able to create the kind of present tense excitement that you rarely get in a documentary. Blackfish is Gabrielle Copperthwaite's film about the psychotic whale Tilikum, and makes a great case for why we should not keep such mammals in captivity. And finally, Alex Gibney's We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, which is much more traditional documentary, but I think everybody should see it if they want to know the story of Julian Assange.
So, David, one of the things that makes end-of-the-year lists and award nominations at the end of the year fun is that you can compare your own taste with the tastes of, you know, the critics you're hearing or the nominations you're reading about. So when you compare your list to the films that have been nominated for awards or have already received awards, where do you feel most in sync and most out of sync?
Well, people will notice that 12 Years a Slave is not one of my best films of the year. It's a very powerful film, and it will get a lot of awards. It's also a very bludgeoning film. And I know that there are people out there saying, well, of course it's bludgeoning. That's what slavers did. They bludgeoned their African-American slaves. Are you a slavery apologist? And from a political standpoint, it's easy to see why the film is so vital. But for me, I got the feeling that the director, whose name is Steve McQueen, likes to fix his camera on people's whose bodies are being defiled. They were starving to death in hunger. They were shaming themselves sexually in shame. And now they're being tortured on camera. And I think I'd watch his films less guardedly if I thought he were searching for something more than his character's reactions to extreme degradation. But, Terry, it's important to say something. Nowadays, there are so many movies that are competing for people's time and their entertainment dollars. And I often find that if I have reservations about a film like 12 Years a Slave or the Coens' Inside Llewyn Davis, people say, oh, you're saying I shouldn't see it. And that's not it at all. I want people to see 12 Years a Slave. I want them to see Inside Llewyn Davis. See it. Wrestle with it. Be part of the conversation. And don't be afraid of ambivalence. Don't be afraid if your thumb doesn't go up or down. That's part of what's wonderful and miraculous about movies, that you can try to sort out your own responses.
You know how some years there's like prestige movies and you know that these movies are designed to get Oscars? What was on your list of that kind of prestige film this year?
Well, a lot of these films, you know, it's such a... Oh. Man, these Oscar campaigns, you do not know what is happening behind the scenes. You do not know what the Academy voters, how they are being bombarded. Talk about bombardment. Every second, phone calls, parties, leaflets, you know, swag of all kinds by people who are pushing their nominees. A lot of films screen for 1 week in New York and L.A. to qualify for the Oscars, and then they open again in February. And, you know, just to get on these Oscar shortlists, everything opens around Christmas time and December, so it's fresh in people's minds. Let me give you an example. Lee Daniels' The Butler this summer was, everybody was talking about this movie as a shoe-in for every Oscar category and every critic award. Well, it's largely forgotten now, except for Oprah Winfrey, who has the money to mount, you know, a colossal Oscar campaign for herself. There's no reason for that, apart from the fact that it opened in August and all these other movies are fresh in people's minds. But I do think Her and American Hustle are opening in time for big awards and are extraordinary films. And they're opening within 3 days of each other. And they're two of the best American films I've seen in years. And you know what else is really interesting about them? They are produced by the same person. They are one of the producers is Megan Ellison. She is 27 years old. She is the daughter of Oracle founder Larry Ellison, obviously comes from billions. And, you know, and she's produced, last year she produced The Master and Zero Dark Thirty. This year she produced American Hustle and Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers and Spike Jonze's Her. And, you know, on one hand, well, it's a reflection of the tremendous inequality in the society. But on the other hand, it gives you hope that, as in the days of Mozart and Beethoven, maybe these rich kids will come out and they'll take their daddy's money and they'll put it into really difficult, interesting films that you know no studio these days would finance.
Getting back to the Oscar campaigns, are they effective? Can the people who actually vote for the Oscars really be effectively lobbied or bought?
Oh, sure. Let me give you an example of that. A few years ago, Julie Christie won all the Critics Awards for her extraordinary performance in Away From Her. Everybody thought she was going to be a shoo-in for the Oscar, but Julie Christie didn't want a campaign. She was somewhat reticent. Whereas Marion Cotillard, who was in the Edith Piaf documentary, they brought her to Hollywood. Nobody knew her. They introduced her at parties. People saw how breathtakingly beautiful she was. I actually think now that Marion Cotillard is one of the world's greatest film actresses. So I'm very happy that she was recognized. But I can tell you in no uncertain terms that her charming all those Oscar voters led directly to her Academy Award.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine, and we're talking about the year in movies. Well, David, it's holiday season, and you know there's a bunch of films that are opening for the holidays or have just opened. Of those films, which would you recommend? And I'll ask you to stick to films that are opening beyond New York and L.A., that are opening beyond just like Oscar consideration.
Mm-hmm. Well, American Hustle is, of course, on my 10 best list, and I could not recommend it more highly. Will Ferrell and Adam McKay do not disgrace themselves in Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues. They finally took the big sequel money, but they feel like they have to earn their salary. So the movie is this overstuffed bounty of cameo roles and the weirdest, most absurdist slapstick imaginable. It does not all work, but you really are seeing people trying so desperately to be weird, and to do something different, and to kind of bombard you with surrealism in a way that you don't see in many comedies. People will go to see The Wolf of Wall Street, the new Martin Scorsese film with Leonardo DiCaprio. I think it's absolutely nightmarishly awful, but there are colleagues of mine who disagree. It's 3 hours essentially of watching this jerk steal money and be an insider trader, scam people, and celebrate by snorting cocaine off the buttocks of hookers and cavort and sleep with everybody and consume conspicuously. And there are scenes that run on and on and on of Leonardo DiCaprio making these insane speeches about the beauty of capitalism. And the only person who does well in the movie, I think, is Kyle Chandler from Friday Night Lights, who underplays everything and surrounded by these desperate overactors. He's this beacon of sanity. He plays this agent on the trail of Leonardo DiCaprio. Okay, so do I recommend the film? Sure, I recommend it. You should see it.
After all that.
After all that, yes, see it. See it. Make up your own mind. August Osage County was from a wonderful play. And, you know, the movie is really misdirected. But there are extraordinary performances by Julia Roberts, of all people, who gives a very finely tuned cinematic performance versus Meryl Streep, who's chewing up the scenery. And there's Margot Martindale and Chris Cooper. It's an extraordinary ensemble cast. The one that I recommend for reasons that have nothing to do with its quality is a film called Labor Day. It's directed by Jason Reitman from a kind of hopelessly bad book by Joyce Maynard. And it's one of the worst films I've ever seen, but it's so hilariously terrible that I think it could turn into a Rocky Horror Picture Show or a Mommy Dearest, where people just sit there and they yell at the screen and they have these rituals. It's about an escaped convict who hides out with this mother and son and becomes a surrogate father. And he's a gourmet cook. So a lot of the movie is him showing them how to make like peach pie. And you're sitting there. He's fixing up the place and he's becoming a dad. And then there's a little bit of sort of PG-13 rated bondage in there to add to the sort of romantic literature, you know, kinkiness of it. Just a great time hooting at this movie.
What are you looking forward to in 2014?
I have no idea.
Because you don't know what's coming out, or you don't really
don't know
what's going to be good.
You know, Terry, and this is really worth saying, because it's my job, I'm lucky enough to be able to go into a film not even knowing the genre. I know the title, maybe I know who's in it, and I sit down and I allow the filmmaker to take me someplace without any preconceptions. I love being that way, and I'm sorry that more and more people go into films having watched The Coming Attractions, which give everything away on the internet or in theaters, having read reviews or heard reviews like mine. I would encourage people just sometime, walk into a movie that you don't even know what it's about. Be transported. Sure, you may be crushed. You may be pissed off. You may be disappointed. On the other hand, you may be enthralled and surprised in a way that you can't be when you've kind of steeped yourself in all the material that surrounds these films before they come out.
Do you not watch trailers, because mostly you're going to screenings where they're not showing trailers, or do you actually make a point of leaving when the trailers are on?
When I see movies in theaters, which I do all the time, I either plug my ears or I leave the seat. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know what the best slapstick moment in a film is. I don't want to know the arc of the story. That's what they give away. They show you oftentimes every beat of the story. Or a film like Nebraska, one of the worst trailers I've ever seen, and I don't necessarily blame the people who made it. I think they're trying to sell this very quiet movie that gets a lot of its power from scenes that kind of carry on in real time in a very low-key way. When you cut it up in order to make it look like some outrageously quirky movie of about this crusty old oldster and people cheering him for, you know, that he's going to be this rich man. When you see a movie like that that gives such a strong misperception of the film, you oftentimes don't even want to see the movie, or you come to it with you know, the worst kind of prejudices.
Well, I guess you'll be nice and surprised in 2014.
I know, you know which directors you love, you know which actors you love. There are certain directors, David O. Russell, I'll see any film he makes. Nicole Holofcener, who made Enough Said this year, I'll go to any film Nicole Holofcener makes in a state of great excitement. So many films this year, what's remarkable about them, the bad and the good, you really feel as if directors are taking chances in their storytelling. They are creating a new syntax for every story. They are finding new and extraordinary ways of, maybe it's even familiar material, but they're going at it through the back door or the side door, or they're mixing up the syntax. And they're reminding you of what is so marvelously elastic about cinema. A lot of us have been raving over the past few years about great television shows like Breaking Bad that have done narratively what film cannot by immersing you in a story for 60-some-odd episodes and allowing you to track a character over time. Maybe movies can't compete narratively with television in that way, but they have extraordinary elasticity in terms of the language, of what they can do, of the order in which they can present things, of the technical magic that they can use. They're creating new forms of narrative that I find so exciting. Even if it's a formula story, to be able to see it with new eyes from a new perspective, that's what movies can do that no other medium can.
Well, David, it's been a lot of fun to talk about the year in film with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for allowing me to do reviews for this wonderful show.
Our absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you for being our film critic. I wish you happy holidays. Have a wonderful new year.
Thank you, Terry.
David Edelstein is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine. You'll find his best of list with his capsule reviews of each film on our website, freshair.npr.org.